and would be at her side. In his view, the greatest threat to the security and prosperity of Poland today was not terrorism, it's not the Taliban, and it's certainly not German tanks. It's not even Russian missiles, which Moscow had just threatened to deploy along the EU's eastern border. In Sikorsky's view, the most ominous scenario was a collapse of the Eurozone, which would no doubt take the weaker states on the Eurozone's periphery with it. And Sikorsky went on, "I demand of Germany that, for your own sake and for ours, you help it survive and prosper. You know full well that nobody else can do it. I will probably be the first Polish foreign minister in history to say so, but here it is. I fear German power less than I am beginning to fear German inactivity. You have become Europe's indispensable nation. You may not fail to lead." A month on from Cannes, in the first week of December 2011, two visions of Europe's future were circulating in Brussels. What Merkel and Sarkozy subscribed to was an updated version of the agenda first agreed at Deauville in 2010, fiscal discipline written into domestic law and international agreements. For France, it offered the safety of association with Germany. Merkel, for her part, needed Sarkozy to counter allegations of German unilateralism. But in light of the widening and escalation of the crisis in 2011, it could not but appear a minimal and essentially negative agenda. In their joint letter to the European Council in early December, Merkel and Sarkozy made no commitments on bank recapitalization and no mention of the simmering crisis in the sovereign bond market. On the most optimistic reading, the Merkel-Sarkozy fiscal compact was the essential political precondition for Germany to take further steps. But in Brussels, the push was now on to actually take those steps. On December 7th, Van Rompuy, the president of the European Council, published his interim report. Though the European Council was supposed to be the guardian of the minimal intergovernmental vision of the Lisbon Treaty, under the pressure of the crisis, Van Rompuy was now calling for bold moves. He proposed a major increase in the financial firepower of the EFSF-ESM. It should be available, in extreme cases, to recapitalize Europe's ailing banks, thus breaking the doom loop. And to back it up, in a longer-term perspective, Van Rompuy called for the EU to face the need for debt mutualization. Limited by strict criteria and all necessary European oversight, there should be some pooling of European credit, shielding the weaker members behind the creditworthiness of the stronger borrowers, thus eliminating the element of market panic that was making the situation of Italy untenable. Some version of these steps was what the entire G20 was calling for. It was what progressive voices in Europe were advocating. Indeed, the idea of Eurobonds was attracting the cautious backing of the German opposition, the SPD. But for Merkel, and in particular for her coalition partners, the FDP, they were anathema. And to add further to German indignation, whereas Sarkozy and Merkel's fiscal compact was to be instituted by solemn amendment of EU treaties, Van Rompuy proposed that his more far-reaching measures could be put through by so-called secondary legislation and limited agreement among the Eurozone members. For Berlin, it was clear. Brussels was up to its usual tricks. At this critical juncture, another force came into play to compound the impasse. Aside from Poland, the other major EU member not in the Eurozone was the UK. London had watched the Eurozone crisis unfold with a mixture of schadenfreude and frustration. On every possible occasion, Prime Minister Cameron lectured the Eurozone members on the need for deeper integration, while at the same time exempting London from any commitments. For the good of Europe, Britain, and the wider world economy, London demanded that the Eurozone move toward full economic union. Meanwhile, for Cameron, struggling to contain an upsurge of Euroscepticism in the Tory party, Europe's crisis was an opportunity to haggle. By exploiting the divisions within the Eurozone, Cameron thought he could obtain explicit opt-outs for the City of London, especially from demands for a tax on financial transactions. But any such concessions were violently opposed by Sarkozy, and Merkel needed France far more than she needed the UK. When he realized that he was isolated, Cameron announced that he would not only veto a collective deal among the 27 EU members, he would exercise his right to block any steps toward deeper integration by the Eurozone members within the framework of the EU. For Britain's relationship to the EU, it was a parting of the ways. It was clear that at least as far as Britain's Conservatives were concerned, a decision would soon be necessary on whether they could continue as cooperative members of the Union. For the Eurozone, what emerged from the clashes of early December 2011 was the lowest common denominator of both options on offer. Germany got its fiscal compact, although it was cast not in the form of the treaty change that Merkel had wanted, but in the minimal legal form of an intergovernmental agreement outside the framework of the Lisbon Treaty. The terms of the fiscal compact were draconian. In the future, Europe's budgets were to be balanced or in surplus. By constitutional amendment, or its equivalent, deficits were to be restricted to 0.5% of GDP. The European Court of Justice was to oversee the transposition of these rules at a national level. States that had a deficit in excess of 3% of GDP would be subject to automatic sanctions unless a qualified majority of states were opposed. Countries with debt levels in excess of 60% of GDP were required to embark on debt reduction. It was the German debt brake vision transposed to the European level. On the broader issue of completing the Eurozone's architecture, Merkel conceded nothing. There would be no shared liability for European borrowing, no euro bonds, no bank recapitalization, and no increase in the size of the EFSF-ESM. The only concession from Berlin was that, as of July 2012, the improvised EFSF would be replaced by a permanent European stability mechanism with the power to intervene in secondary bond markets, and the adequacy of the EU's firewall would be reassessed as soon as March 2012. Berlin also agreed to lay the ghosts of Deauville to rest by limiting any future PSI to standards set by the IMF. Despite the intensity of the Italian crisis and the drama at Cannes, it was still Germany that set the pace. With intergovernmentalism resulting in such minimal and essentially negative solutions, would the one powerful federal agency of the Eurozone, the ECB, rise to the challenge? All eyes were on Mario Draghi, who had taken over as president of the ECB on November 1, 2011. At the Treasury in Rome in the 1990s, he had been a crucial member of the team that carried Italy into the euro. Since 2006, he had been in the spotlight as governor of the Bank of Italy. Before that, he had served as a vice chairman at Goldman Sachs, following a stint at the World Bank. He had earned his PhD in economics in the cradle of American macroeconomics, MIT, in the 1970s, at the same time as Ben Bernanke and Loukas Papademos, who was now serving as Greek Prime Minister. At MIT, Mervyn King of the Bank of England and Bernanke had been office mates. Between them, the central banking fraternity at least had an immediate answer to the problems facing Europe's financial system. The banks were under enormous pressure from the withdrawal of wholesale funding, and the shortage of dollar funding was particularly acute. It was horribly reminiscent of 2008. To relieve the funding pressures caused by the withdrawal of the American money market funds, the Bank of France, among others, had resorted to emergency measures to make dollars available to French banks. Now, on November 30th, all the major central banks of the world, the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the Swiss National Bank, and the Bank of Canada, reopened the swap lines put in place in 2008 and reduced the interest rate paid. The global reach of the deal was theater. Japanese and Canadian banks were not under any pressure. It was, once more, the Eurozone that needed the dollars. In the summer of 2012, Mario Draghi would emerge as the savior of the euro. As such, he would be demonized as an Italian inflationist by the German right wing and celebrated by the Anglophone world as a competent central banker. But what this narrative ignores is that Draghi's ability to change the conversation in the summer of 2012 had one essential precondition: backing from Berlin. Commonly, the strength of Draghi's relationship with Merkel is put down to Draghi's finesses as a politician. But this passes over the fact that though German hardliners opposed all activism by Europe's central bank, for Merkel, the ECB had been a useful tool from the start. She had done it quietly, but on several occasions she had effectively distanced herself from the Bundesbank, recognizing that ECB intervention was the necessary complement to the decade-long process of transferring Germany's vision of reform to the rest of Europe. Despite the howls of protest from the German right wing, Merkel knew she could count on Europe's central bankers. She had nothing to fear from a fiscal and monetary conservative like Trichet. Draghi was suitable as a partner precisely because he showed every sign of agreeing with Germany's vision of how to revise the European welfare state. Indeed, that was as much part of Draghi's identity as an American-trained economist and Goldman Sachs alumnus as was his expansive view of central bank policy. As Draghi reminded the readers of the Financial Times shortly after taking over at the ECB, he was a veteran of Italy's tough stabilization efforts of the 1990s. In August 2011, Draghi co-signed Trichet's ultimatum to Berlusconi, demanding changes to Italy's public services and labor markets. Draghi shared with his predecessor both the frustration over Rome's evasiveness and the foot-dragging of the rest of Europe's governments. On December 1, 2011, Draghi marked the beginning of his ECB presidency by appearing before the European Parliament to throw his weight behind the Merkel-Sarkozy plan for fiscal discipline. And his sympathy with German demands for reform was unfeigned. As Draghi told the Wall Street Journal in February 2012, Europe's social model that prioritized job security and social welfare was already gone. What, after all, did talk of a social model mean when 50% of Spanish youth were unemployed? Europe's labour markets would have to be reinvented, presumably along the lines of Germany's Hartz IV agenda. In his grad student days at MIT in the 1970s, Draghi recalled, his American professors had marvelled at Europe's willingness to pay everybody for not working. That's gone. For the new head of the ECB, there was no feasible trade-off between labour market reform and fiscal austerity. Backtracking on fiscal targets would elicit an immediate reaction by the market, and Draghi made clear that he had no intention of softening that discipline. In December 2011, in conversation with the Financial Times, he refused to discuss putting the ECB behind the EFSF as the ultimate guarantor of the EU's firewall. Nor would he countenance talk of QE for Europe. He started his term in office by insisting that Trichet's bond-buying program, the securities market program, was neither eternal nor infinite. Indeed, given Draghi's subsequent reputation, it bears repeating that as of 2012, his first year in office, bond-buying by the ECB ceased. His priority was to restore a system where the citizens will go back to trusting each other and where governments are trusted on fiscal discipline and structural reforms. What Draghi was willing to do immediately was to prop up the banks. The swap lines were one mechanism. Another was to revive the ECB's familiar device of cheap bank funding. With credit markets spooked in 2009 and 2010, Europe's banks had been forced to resort to increasingly short-term funding sources, which now needed to be rolled over. If they could not find new funding, the eurozone was threatened by a major credit crunch. Already in October 2011, the ECB had announced that it would be offering liquidity to the European banking system in the form of the long-term refinancing operation, LTRO, long-term loans at highly favourable interest rates. Draghi opened the spigot, offering financing at favourable rates over the unprecedentedly long term of 3 years, and taking much lower grades of collateral. On December 21, 2011, 523 banks took €489 billion in funding. In February, there were 800 takers for another €500 billion. Of the first tranche of the LTRO, 65% went to banks in the stressed periphery: Italy, Spain, Ireland, and Greece. Though Draghi hastened to explain that this was obviously not at all an equivalent to the ECB stepping up bond buying, in due course the trillion euros in LTRO loans would feed back into bank purchases of sovereign debt. This raised demand in bond markets and lowered yields. It supported the sovereign debt market. It allowed banks to earn easy profits on the spread between the 1% charged by the ECB and the 5% on offer for those willing to hold Italian government bonds. But as in 2009, it came at a price. Rather than allowing Europe's fragile banks to unload dubious assets in exchange for safe cash, as QE did in the United States, the ECB's program added to their holdings of peripheral government debt. Spanish and Italian banks were particularly proactive. Banks and sovereigns were thus tied ever more closely together. And neither side was safe. On January 14th, S&P conducted a review of its European sovereign ratings and downgraded 7 of them. France and Austria lost their prized AAA rating. Portugal was reduced to junk. Within the Eurozone, only Germany, the Netherlands, Finland, and Luxembourg retained their coveted AAA rating. Even the Eurozone's own bailout fund, the EFSF, ESM, was at risk of a downgrade. The Europeans protested, as had Washington following its downgrade by S&P, but this time the ratings agency was firm in its judgment. Months of negotiations had not produced a breakthrough of sufficient size to warrant optimism about the Eurozone's future. Despite the Sturm und Drang of the fall of 2011, the political impasse had not been broken. Control of the timeline was everything, and Berlin set the pace. At the G20, outside the Caen Palais de Festival on November 5th, Merkel had opined, "The debt crisis will not be solved all in one go, and it is certain that it will take us a decade to get back to a better position." That was revealing as to Germany's time horizon, but the question was, did the rest of Europe have that long? Chapter 18. Whatever it takes. In the first half of 2012, the rotating presidency of the G20 fell to Mexico. On Friday, January 20th, 2012, a week after the S&P downgrade of Eurozone sovereigns, finance officials from around the world assembled in Mexico City. On their agenda was a remarkable request. The Eurozone members of the G20 were calling on the rest of the world to contribute $300 to $400 billion in additional funding to enable the IMF to backstop crisis fighting, not in an emerging market or in one of the less developed countries of sub-Saharan Africa, but in Europe. The non-European members of the G20, led by the United States, China, and Brazil, considered the European request and turned it down. As Mexico's deputy finance minister remarked to the press, "There is a recognition of the measures Europe has taken, but it's also clear that more needs to be done." Amid the din of world events, the incident barely warranted a headline. But the location of the meeting, the nature of the request, and the response by the rest of the G20 add up to a remarkable historical denouement. It was also indicative of the precarious state in which the Eurozone was left hanging by the bruising battles of 2011. The G20 and S&P concurred. The Europeans had not done enough. They had not squarely addressed the basic instabilities with regard to the sovereign bond market and bank recapitalization, which had sucked the IMF into its engagement in Europe back in 2010. They had eventually recognized Greece's insolvency and were on the point of pushing through a debt restructuring. That was essential. But haircutting Greece's creditors served only to increase pressure in bond markets. In political terms, Europe had satisfied the German insistence on austerity, which Berlin promised would open the door to further steps toward integration. But December 2011 revealed how reluctant Berlin was to actually make the next move. Meanwhile, The consensus that had been built around austerity policies in 2010 was beginning to crumble. The European Fiscal Compact of December 2011 was imposed by force of Franco-German cooperation. But Sarkozy was up for re-election in May 2012, and his main rivals for the presidency, the Socialists, were campaigning against the agreement. That was predictable. What was less so was that the IMF itself would be calling for a rethink. In its briefing for the full meeting of finance ministers and central bank governors that would convene in Mexico City on February 25th and 26th, 2012, the IMF's headline was stark. The overarching risk to the world economy was of an intensified global paradox of thrift. As households, firms, and governments around the world all tried to cut their deficits at once, there was an acute risk of global recession. This risk is further exacerbated, the IMF went on, by fragile financial systems, high public deficits and debt, and already low interest rates, making the current environment fertile ground for multiple equilibria, self-perpetuating outcomes resulting from pessimism or optimism, notably in the euro area. The place where the paradoxes of thrift were most visible was Greece. In the protracted struggle to get to the October 2011 debt deal for Greece, the entire discussion had revolved around the Greek budget and concessions to be made by its creditors. The 50% haircut had been forced through in the hope of getting Greece to a debt level of 120% of GDP. From there, according to the mandatory fiscal adjustment procedure specified in Sarkozy and Merkel's fiscal compact, it would be possible to get Greece down to a debt ratio of 60% of GDP, the target originally specified in the Maastricht Treaty. The fiscal arithmetic was pleasing, but what it ignored were the feedback loops highlighted by the IMF. The problem in achieving debt sustainability was Greece's collapsing GDP as much as it was its elevated debt level. By the time of the discussions in Mexico in early 2012, it was clear that the deal hammered out 3 months earlier was no longer viable, not because the Greek government or the creditors were reneging, but because the Greek economy was contracting too fast. For many European governments, at this point, enough was enough. They could not ask their parliaments to consider yet another Greek rescue. It was time to consider more radical options. Rather than trying to manage a negotiated restructuring, perhaps it would be better to leave Greece to its fate. An outright default might result in Greece tumbling out of the eurozone, but Greece would at least be free of its debts. And if new borrowing was shut off, Athens would be forced to adopt fiscal discipline as a matter of sheer survival. It was in early 2012 that top-secret planning began for the eventuality of a Grexit. Work on the so-called Plan Z would continue until August 2012, when it was finally stopped by Berlin. It was stopped because the upshot of the planning exercises was always the same. It would likely be ruinous for Greece, and the ramifications of Grexit for the rest of Europe were entirely unpredictable. They were unpredictable because Europe still had not built an adequate shield to protect the other fragile Eurozone members from the fallout from a Greek bankruptcy. It was to reinforce and extend that inadequate safety net that the Europeans were applying to the G20 to support an expanded IMF facility. But the G20's answer was clear. The rest of the world would regard Grexit as a failure not just of Greece, but also on the part of the larger European states that pretended to global standing as members of the G20. On February 19, 2012, Japan and China, in a rare show of unity, declared that they were willing to back the appeal for increased IMF funding, but only if the Europeans raised the cap on the ESM stability mechanism, to which the Bundestag was clinging. The Europeans must help themselves first. The ESM expansion would come at the end of March. Berlin blocked any truly dramatic move, but by counting the money already dispersed to Greece, allowing the EFSF facilities to continue, and raising the combined lending limit of EFSF and ESM to 700 billion euros, Europe could claim that it was mobilizing a firewall of 800 billion euros, or more than $1 trillion. It was a fudge that allowed the IMF board to sign off on continued support for Europe's stabilization efforts. But what no one in Europe wanted to do in early 2012 was to renegotiate the Greek deal of October 2011. The governments had committed 130 billion euros, and that was the limit. If Greece was sliding further away from sustainability, it was up to the Greek government to make further savings, and up to the creditors to make further concessions. A new round of negotiations with the IIF began in February, which yielded an increase in the haircut from 50 to 53.5%. What was left of the Greek debt would be exchanged for two-year notes backed by the EFSF and long-dated low-coupon bonds. For this modest advance on the October programme to offer any hope of fiscal sustainability, it would take extreme discipline on the part of Athens. And that begged the next question. Having ousted Papandreou as Prime Minister in a backroom coup after aborting his referendum proposal, the Troika had fashioned for themselves a cooperative government in Athens. But by the same token, Papademos, the central banker turned Prime Minister, lacked legitimacy. Elections were scheduled for April 2012, and he would surely lose. The main opposition party, New Democracy, had presided over the onset of the crisis and had consistently refused to support Papandreou's government in the negotiations since 2010. So that placed any new agreement with Athens in question from the start. How were the Greeks to be nailed down? With typical forthrightness, German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble suggested that perhaps it would be better for the Greeks not to hold elections. Suspending Greek democracy would allow the key measures to be put through before the voters were given a chance to have their say. But that suggestion provoked outrage in Athens. So instead, what the Troika managed to extract was a promise from the hitherto evasive leader of New Democracy, Antonis Samaras, that if he were to take office, he would abide by any deal negotiated by his predecessors. Whatever happened in the elections, the fiscal programme would have priority. On that basis, Greece and its creditors engaged in the latest round of extend and pretend. To describe the debt restructuring of 2012 in these terms, as no more than a continuation of the makeshift measures that had characterized the Greek debt crisis from the beginning, may seem unduly dismissive. The restructuring that was forced on the creditors of Greece between February and April of 2012 was the largest and most severe in history, larger in inflation-adjusted terms than the Russian Revolutionary default or Germany's default of the 1930s. By April 26, 2012, 199.2 billion euros in Greek government bonds were converted in exchange for 29.7 billion in short-term cash equivalent notes drawn on the EFSF and 62.4 billion in new long-term bonds at concessionary rates. All told, Greece's private creditors had conceded a reduction of 107 billion euros. Allowing for the much later repayment of the new long-term bonds, the net present value of claims on Greece was cut by 65%. In December 2012, the claims of private creditors were further reduced by a buyback of the recently issued long-dated bonds. The problem was that the funds to sweeten the deal and induce the creditors to engage in the voluntary write-down did not come out of thin air. Nor did the money to pay for recapitalizing the Greek banks in the wake of the restructuring, or to pay for the December 2012 buyback. All this was funded by new borrowing from the Troika. Furthermore, the 56 billion euros in Greek bonds held by the ECB were exempt from the 2012 restructuring. So the overall reduction in Greece's debt burden was far less than advertised. As a result of the debt restructuring of 2012, Greece's public debt was reduced from 350 billion to 285 billion euros, a 19% reduction. The really dramatic transformation was not in the quantity of debt, but in who it was owed to. 80% was now owed to public creditors, the EFSF, the ECB, or the IMF. In effect, Greece swapped a reduction of its obligations to private creditors of 161.6 billion euros for an increase in obligations to public creditors of 98.8 billion euros. This substitution was the one constant in the endlessly shifting politics of Greek debt. Public claims replaced private debts. And this is revealed even more starkly if we look not at stocks of debt, but at flows of funds. Of the 226.7 billion euros that Greece was to receive in financing from European sources and the IMF between May 2010 and the summer of 2014, the vast majority flowed straight back out of Greece in debt service and repayment. Creditors in Greece and elsewhere received 81.3 billion euros in repayment of principal. Those creditors lucky enough to have debts maturing before the date of the restructuring were paid in full. It was precisely the arbitrariness of this outcome that led the IMF, under normal circumstances, to oppose emergency lending to insolvent debtors. For Greece, they had made an exception on systemic grounds. On top of that, 40.6 billion euros were used to make regular interest payments, again to creditors in both Greece and the rest of the world. To sweeten the debt exchange of 2012, 34.6 billion euros were used to provide some incentive to those who had clung to their bonds. Recapitalizing the Greek banks, whose balance sheets were destroyed by the restructuring, took 48.2 billion euros. This meant that altogether, of the 226.7 billion euros in assistance loans received by Greece, only 11% went toward meeting the needs of the Greek government deficit and directly to the benefit of the Greek taxpayer. The bond market was no longer the principal arbiter of Greece's financial fate, but for that it substituted the full weight of the Troika, the IMF, the EU, the ECB, and the national governments of Europe. It was now with them that Athens would have to negotiate its financial future. This had two sides. On the one hand, as non-market lenders, the Greek loan facility and the EFSF could decide on loan terms by political fiat. In 2010, the terms had been punitive. By the spring of 2012, the EFSF was offering Athens long-dated loans on concessionary terms. Though the headline debt figure remained exorbitant, annual debt servicing charges were more modest. On the other hand, without the private cushion, the politics of Greek debt were now stark. Concessions to Greece came directly at the expense of the Troika, and that meant, above all, the taxpayers of the rest of Europe. Negotiations would be tough and overtly political, and they could not be avoided. The 2012 restructuring had not answered the question of Greece's solvency. The question of restructuring would return. In 2009, when the crisis began, Greece's public debt had stood at around 299 billion euros. As a result of the crisis, it has surged to 350 billion euros. The 2012 deal cut it back to 285 billion euros. But in the interim, as a result of the recession, the eurozone crisis, and the policies demanded by the creditors, the Greek economy had crash-landed. Whereas in 2009, Greece's GDP had stood at roughly 240 billion euros, in the course of 2012, it would slump to 191.1 billion euros. If Greece's debts had been unsustainable in 2009, in 2012, even allowing for the concessions granted by the official creditors, it clearly still was. In the interim, Greek society had been battered beyond recognition. In 2008, Greek unemployment had been 8%. 4 years later, it was rising inexorably toward 25%. Half of young Greeks were without jobs. In a nation of 10 million, a quarter of a million people were fed daily at church-run food banks and soup kitchens. Meanwhile, the Greek parliament had been reduced to a factory for decrees demanded by the Troika. In the 18 months following the May 2010 bailout, the Athens parliament had whipped through 248 laws, one every 3 days. By 2012, it wasn't only the trade unionists and the Greek left who were up in arms. Judges, military officials, and civil servants were mounting resistance to the subordination of the Greek state. And there were other ways of expressing dissatisfaction and distrust. In the spring of 2012, the draining of funds from Greek banks accelerated at an alarming rate. As the election now scheduled for May 2012 approached, the Eurosystem was discreetly sluicing billions in cash into Greece to preserve a veneer of normality. In total, 28.5 billion euros were quietly airlifted into Greece to disguise the size of a bank run. On May 6th, the population was finally given its say. The result was a spectacular demonstration of quite how deep disillusionment went. PASOK, the party that since the 1970s had been identified more than any other with Greece's democratic transformation, and which had had the misfortune of governing during the worst of the crisis, saw its vote share fall from 43.9% to 13.2%. The new left-wing movement, Syriza, together with the communist KKE, garnered almost twice as many votes as PASOK. On the right, New Democracy plunged from 34% to 18%, while the fascist Golden Dawn scored 7%. Even with the 50-seat parliamentary bonus awarded to New Democracy as the leading party in the polls, no government could be formed. New elections were called for June 17th. In the meantime, Greece hung in mid-air. There was no mandate for a government that was willing to accept responsibility for the measures that the Eurogroup insisted were essential for it to remain in the Eurozone. As Schäuble and numerous other European politicians made clear, the Greek vote in June would be a referendum on its continued Euro membership. The Greeks were not the only voters to deliver their verdict on the track record of Europe on May 6, 2012. That same day, in the second round of the French presidential elections, the voters rejected Sarkozy in favour of the socialist François Hollande. Sarkozy's promise to hold France in line with Germany was not what the voters wanted. Hollande had campaigned on an anti-privilege, anti-bank platform, proposing taxes on higher earners and on financial transactions. He promised that he would renegotiate Merkozy's fiscal compact of December 2011. The key to sound finances, as the new French government saw it, was not self-defeating austerity, but growth. Crucially, Hollande gained not only the French presidency, the socialists also won the National Assembly elections in June. There was a solid majority in France, it seemed, not for conformity to the Merkozy vision, but for change. And the mood was shared on the left in Germany. Though they had co-authored Germany's own debt break, the SPD was alarmed by the disastrous development in the Eurozone. They were soaring in the polls, and what the SPD demanded in 2012 was a new focus not on debt and fiscal sustainability, but on growth. And this appeal received support from an unexpected corner, the IMF. The emphasis on the paradox of thrift in the G20 briefing for Mexico City was the first sign of a major shift in fund thinking on fiscal policy. In the summer of 2012, its staff revisited the forecasts they had made in the spring of 2010 as the Eurozone crisis began, and discovered that they had systematically underestimated the negative impact of budget cuts. Whereas they had started the crisis believing that the multiplier was on average around 0.5%, they now concluded that from 2010 forward, it had been in excess of 1. This meant that cutting government spending by 1 euro, as the austerity programs demanded, would reduce economic activity by more than 1 euro. So the share of the state in economic activity actually increased rather than decreased, as the programs presupposed. It was a staggering admission. Bad economics and faulty empirical assumptions had led the IMF to advocate a policy that destroyed the economic prospects for a generation of young people in southern Europe. The conservative coalition in Berlin was losing its grip. In the French presidential election, Merkel's engagement on the side of Sarkozy had been unabashed. She refused to make even a token appearance with Hollande, who was publicly challenging the fiscal compact. It was probably to Hollande's benefit. Now Berlin would have to hold the line without its major European partner. Nor were Merkel's problems only across the Rhine. At home, the popularity of the CDU-FDP government was sagging. The coalition had been built on the extraordinary surge in support garnered by the market-liberal, Eurosceptic FDP in 2009 in the wake of the first phase of the crisis and the unpopular bank bailouts. By 2012, that support was fading. On May 13th, the CDU faced important regional elections in Nordrhein-Westfalen, NRW. With a population of 17 million and a GDP almost three times that of Greece, NRW was the largest state in the Federal Republic. Home to the Ruhr, it was a former heavy industrial area struggling to find a place for itself in a world in which China, not Germany, made the steel. Tellingly, the polls in NRW were triggered early because of the inability of its regional government to draft a budget in conformity with the debt brake that the Grand Coalition had imposed on Germany in 2009. For Merkel, the result was devastating. The SPD surged. A new protest party, the Pirates, entered the regional parliament, and Merkel's CDU slumped to 26%. It was by far the worst result for her party in this crucial state since the founding of the Federal Republic. And then, as if to compound the political upheavals of May, the last aftershock of the real estate crisis struck in Spain. Along with Ireland, Spain had the distinction of experiencing one of the most extreme housing bubbles in the world. When that burst, the effect, as in Ireland, was devastating. The difference is that Spain is big, with a population of more than 45 million, compared with Ireland's 4.5 million. Before the crisis, Spain's economy was comparable in size to that of the state of Texas. So the bursting of the Spanish bubble was an event of macroscopic proportions. As the housing market collapsed, Spain's unemployment rate shot up. Of the 6.6 million increase in unemployment in the Eurozone between 2007 and 2012, 3.9 million was accounted for by Spain, 60% of that grim total. As bad as Greece's situation was, it was small by comparison and accounted for only 12% of the increase in Eurozone unemployment. Most catastrophic of all was Spain's youth unemployment rate, which by the summer of 2012 had surged to 55%. Even allowing for an extensive black economy, it was a deeply dismaying statistic. Unlike Dublin, Spain's social democratic government managed to keep the travails of its mortgage banks, the regional cajas, out of the headlines in the first phase of the global crisis. A bailout fund took many of the worst loans off their books. In 2010, the weakest cajas, many of them entangled with Spain's two leading political parties, were aggregated into a bad bank, Bankia BFA. The number of cajas was cut from 45 to 17, but at the price of creating a larger and more dangerous entity. At 328 billion euros, Bankia's balance sheet ran to 30% of Spanish GDP. Not surprisingly, despite endorsement by global investment banks, the attempt to sell Bankia shares to global investors was an embarrassing flop. In November 2011, as the crisis reached its height, the socialists called a snap election, which handed power to a new conservative government headed by the People's Party of Mariano Rajoy. It is unclear whether Rajoy's cabinet grasped the severity of the situation. Perhaps Spain's Christian Democrats hoped for solidarity from Berlin. If so, they were disappointed, and Madrid's tone toward the EU became more belligerent. New loss provisions called for from the Spanish banks were inadequate to calm the markets. By the spring of 2012, only huge injections of liquidity from the ECB were keeping Spain's financial system afloat. But maintaining liquidity was not the same as restoring solvency. On May 9, 2012, Bankia declared that it was on the point of bankruptcy and urgently needed recapitalization. By May 25, with Bankia under new management, the figure had risen to 19 billion euros in new capital. With its economy already depressed, the last thing Spain needed was a new round of banking crises. And it would be even worse if a bank bailout spiraled, Irish-style, into a bank-sovereign doom loop. Following the Bankia announcement, yields on Spanish public debt surged to 6% and then began to inch up towards 7%, above which Spain's debt burden would begin to snowball, as rising debt service costs further inflated the deficit. By May 2012, it was clear that Europe was once again sliding toward the edge. Bond market yields were rising around the periphery. It was a dire outlook. According to IMF figures, in the course of 2012 alone, Europe's governments and banks needed to roll over and refinance debts amounting to an impressive 23% of GDP. They simply could not afford interest rates to surge out of control as a result of a panic in Spain. It was the looming crisis in Spain that forced the question of comprehensive eurozone reform, which had been blocked by Merkel over the winter of 2011 to 2012, back onto the agenda. At the end of April, speaking to the European Parliament, Draghi called for a political roadmap to frame further moves toward fiscal union. Meanwhile, France's new president and Mario Monti's embattled government in Rome were coordinating their positions. With Italy's yields inching ominously upward, Monti needed a Europe-wide fix. Would the Spanish crisis result in a basic change in position, or simply another iteration of German delaying tactics? If Merkel continued to veto any talk of sovereign debt pooling, would she be more flexible on the issue of bank recapitalization? Would a banking union with collective responsibility for banking supervision and bailouts finally unlock the door to a eurozone solution? On June 9, 2012, eurozone finance ministers agreed that the situation in Spain was so urgent that Madrid should be provided with 100 billion euros from EU resources to fund recapitalization. To stop the doom loop, however, what was required was a separate Europe-wide bank bailout fund that had the resources to intervene in and recapitalize banks directly. If instead the funds injected into the Spanish banks were booked to the Spanish government's accounts, it risked amplifying the crisis. As if to prove the point, on June 14, 2012, Moody's downgraded Spain to a rating of Baa3, one notch above junk. The future of the European Union, Spain's foreign minister declared, would be played out in the next few days. And as he reminded Berlin, when the Titanic sinks, it takes everyone with it, even those travelling in first class. Indeed, the casualties list might stretch beyond Europe. Spain was not in Italy's league, but from Spain the crisis could easily spread outward. As had repeatedly been the case since 2010, the eurozone's failure to resolve its internal problems made Europe into the world's problem. In May 2012, the telephone log of Tim Geithner at the US Treasury shows an ominous spike, with dozens of calls to Brussels, the IMF, and eurozone finance ministers. At the Camp David meeting of the G8, on May 18th to 19th, Obama took Merkel and Monti aside for an eyebrow-raising two-and-a-half-hour side meeting. In November 2011, at the G20 in Cannes, the eurozone had dominated the talks. 9 months later, as the G20 summit convened in the glaring sunlight of the gated Mexican resort of Los Cabos, Europe was still at the top of the agenda. The world's policy experts, politicians, and media had come to terms with the fact that the eurozone's problems were not only not fixed, but getting worse by the day. The impatience was palpable. At a press conference on June 19th, the questions put to Commission President Barroso were so aggressive that he lost his cool. In response to a Canadian journalist asking about the risks to North America emanating from the eurozone, Barroso snapped back, "Frankly, we are not here to receive lessons in terms of democracy or in terms of how to handle the economy. This crisis was not originated in Europe. Seeing as you mentioned North America, this crisis originated in North America, and much of our financial sector was contaminated by, how can I put it, unorthodox practices from some sectors of the financial market." And continuing in this self-righteous vein, Barroso added that Europe was a community of democracies. Finding the right strategy took time. Several of the G20 were not even democracies. What did Europe have to learn from them? Clearly, old hierarchies die hard. But equally clearly, Europe needed help. At Cannes, Obama had tried to work through Sarkozy to shift the German position. That had failed. Sarkozy would not risk a breach with Merkel. By the summer of 2012, Washington had more levers to bring to bear. Italy's premier, Mario Monti, had visited the White House early in 2012 and was hailed by Time magazine as a potential savior of Europe. Though he was the godfather of the Bocconi School of Neoclassical Economics and a classic Italian free market liberal, Monti had become convinced that the Eurozone bond markets could no longer be trusted. Speculators were pricing into their assessment of Italian and Spanish bonds not the particular fiscal situation in those countries, but the probability of a systematic breakdown. The talk was of redenomination risk, and for that there could only be a collective solution. But to shift the Eurozone into action, Monti needed allies. Washington was supportive, but it was the break in the Mercosur front in May 2012 that was decisive. Not only was the newly elected Hollande pressing for a new emphasis on stimulus and growth, but officials in the French Treasury were coming around to the idea of a banking union. The speculative pressure they had seen unleashed in the autumn of 2011, when Dexia failed and France's own credit rating was in doubt, had convinced them that without risk pooling, no one was safe. As a third, Monti and Hollande could count on Mariano Rajoy, Spain's Christian Democratic Prime Minister. Rajoy was no visionary. Indeed, he often gave the impression that he barely grasped the extremity of Spain's situation. But there was no doubt that Madrid desperately needed the talk of a Eurozone breakup to end. On the second day at Los Cabos, Obama and Monti sprang a trap. In a one-on-one meeting with Merkel, the American president presented the German chancellor with a plan that had been drafted by the Italians. The scheme proposed that for states that were running suitably responsible fiscal policies, the ECB or the ESM should put a cap on bond market yields. If yields rose above the threshold of sustainability, this would trigger intervention to restore a more normal level of interest rates. It would be a quasi-automatic mechanism that did not require intrusive inspection or supervision of the Troika variety. Merkel indignantly refused even to discuss the idea, on the procedural grounds that it had not been cleared in advance with her staff. She would accept no proposal that blurred the line between monetary and fiscal policy from whatever source it came. For the Germans, the autonomy of the ECB remained sacrosanct. The tone was tense, and it was thought that it would be best to cancel the after-dinner plenary that had been scheduled at Obama's request. Enough had been said in private conversations. No one wanted to repeat the scenes at Cannes. Once more, Merkel had stopped a transatlantic push for emergency action. But pressure was now building on both sides of the Atlantic. On June 17th, to general relief, the Greek election had clarified the political scene to the point at which a new government could be formed. PASOK was wiped out. Voters now clustered around New Democracy on the right and Syriza on the left. For those opposed to the Troika, Syriza was now the main choice. Samaras formed a government on June 20th. A government was better than no government, but given Samaras's track record during the crisis to date, it was hard to know what to expect. Would he stick to his commitment to honour the agreements of the Papademos government? The answer was far from obvious, and planning for the possibility of Grexit continued. In any case, by June 2012, Greece was no longer the main concern. If some concerted collective action plan was not put in place, Spain was in mortal danger, and Italy would soon follow. Scrambling for leverage, Monti and Hollande convened a meeting in Rome on June 22nd to agree on a growth pact for Europe, notionally to be worth 130 billion euros in investments and tax breaks. They knew that Merkel was vulnerable because her FDP coalition partners were trying to save their skins by rallying the Eurosceptic vote and opting out of the Chancellor's European policy. This left Merkel dependent on the opposition SPD, who were coordinating their position with the French socialists. The SPD demanded German backing for a growth agenda as the price for their votes in the Bundestag. Further multiplying the fronts on which Merkel had to fight, on June 26, the so-called Quadriga, European Council President Herman Van Rompuy, European Central Bank Head Mario Draghi, European Commission President José Manuel Barroso, and Eurogroup Chair Jean-Claude Juncker, returned to the vision that Berlin had vetoed in December. They proposed a banking union backed by Eurozone-wide deposit insurance and a joint crisis fund. Nor did they shrink from suggesting the need for shared debt issuance. Merkel's response was not long in coming. Within 24 hours, she used a meeting of her coalition partners, the FDP, to announce, "There will be no collectivization of debt in the European Union for as long as I live." In Germany, the drumroll against additional Eurozone bailouts was mounting. Merkel's room for manoeuvre was further tightened on June 21st, when the Federal Constitutional Court ruled that in agreeing with France's demand to bring forward the creation of the ESM to the summer of 2012, the government had violated the Bundestag's right to prior consultation. The message was clear. There must be no backdoor bailouts. On June 28, 2012, the European Council convened in Brussels in an atmosphere of deep crisis. Spain was clearly sliding toward the abyss. 3 days earlier, Madrid had formally applied for 100 billion euros in external assistance to recapitalize and restructure its banks. To stop the impending disaster, there was no alternative but for the Council to approve the creation of a banking union. This would provide for the direct recapitalization of banks, independent of their home country governments, once an effective overall supervisory regime was established. Finally, a structural solution adequate to the crisis was coming into view. In the short term, Germany agreed to an immediate bailout for the Spanish banks, provided a strict stress test was applied. This was a step of enormous significance. 4 years on, from 2008, what Europe was finally acknowledging was that even more than a fiscal union, what the Eurozone needed was joint responsibility for its financial sector. What this did not resolve, however, was the boiling uncertainty in government debt markets. For Italy and Spain, facing interest rates rising towards 7% and beyond, this was a life-or-death issue. They could not hope to stabilize their public finances unless bond markets were calmed. On the evening of June 28, Monti and Rajoy forced a showdown. Just as Council President Van Rompuy was about to announce Europe's crowd-pleasing new growth pact to the press, they declared that they would veto the pact unless there was an agreement also to address the new crisis in sovereign bond markets. It was an ambush. For Merkel to have lost the growth pact would have left her vulnerable in the Bundestag. But she had also promised to hold the line on bank bailouts and bond buying, and now she was at risk of capitulating on both. It took until 4:20 in the morning on June 29th for the Chancellor to finally give way. After a negotiating session lasting a total of 15 hours, Barroso and Van Rompuy went before the press to announce agreement not only on the growth pact, but also on a plan that would permit support by the ESM for the government debt of all countries that were in compliance with the rules of fiscal governance agreed in December. It would be the entitlement of all Eurozone members, not emergency assistance granted by way of a humiliating application to the Troika. As he left the meeting, a jubilant Monti exclaimed, "Europe's mental block has been broken." It was indeed a breakthrough. But in both political and financial terms, in July 2012, the Eurozone was still in flux. Merkel's retreat did not pacify the German conservatives. The new Greek government was still regarded as a liability. Meanwhile, Spain was spiraling toward disaster. To trigger the bond market support mechanism, a Eurozone member had to conform to the 3% deficit rule. Spain was a long way from that. In the summer of 2012, it was struggling to slash its budget deficit from 11.2% to 5.4% of GDP. The Eurogroup was still working out the details of the Spanish bank recapitalization. As the Spanish banking system suffered a silent bank run and the interbank lending market shut down, Spain's banks drew a massive 376 billion euros in funding from the ECB. The regional governments across Spain were in trouble. In July, Valencia applied to Madrid for aid. Catalonia might be next. On July 23rd, the Spanish 10-year bond surged to 7.5%, and its CDS shot up to 633 basis points. That same day, the Spanish Minister for Economic Affairs, Luis de Guindos, jetted to Berlin in the hope of obtaining an endorsement from Schäuble that might reassure markets and open the door to ECB bond buying. Spain was facing, de Guindos warned, an imminent financial collapse. But Schäuble was grudging in the support he was willing to give his fellow Christian Democrat. For Germany to approve immediate bond buying, Madrid would need to make changes to its pension system and demonstrate its commitment to budget balance. Conformity to Germany's idea of the European social bargain was the price for backing from Berlin. The Eurozone still hung in the balance. 3 days later, on Thursday, July 26, Mario Draghi flew to London ahead of the opening of the Olympic Games to attend a global investment conference designed to promote the UK as a business centre. The mood in London was not friendly. Mervyn King, speaking ahead of Draghi on the panel, let it be known that he did not regard European political union as a possible solution. As Draghi later confided to a friend, "I really got fed up. All those stories about the dissolution of the euro really suck." The expression he used in Italian was apparently rather more colourful. So Draghi decided to change the script. The markets needed to understand the qualitative change that Europe was undergoing. The Eurozone might have started life as an ill-shapen construction, but under the pressure of the crisis, it was developing fast. Global markets needed to appreciate the fundamental changes that were reshaping Europe. Following the December 2011 fiscal pact, the summit of June 2012 was a turning point because for the first time since 2008, all the leaders had restated with a powerful voice that the only way out of this present crisis is to have more Europe, not less Europe. The forward motion of the EU's integration machine was resumed. The point that Draghi wanted to drive home to global markets was political. When people talk about the fragility of the euro, and the increasing fragility of the euro, and perhaps the crisis of the euro, he told the sceptical City of London crowd, very often non-euro area member states or leaders underestimate the amount of political capital that is being invested in the euro. These were not empty words, because actions have been made, are being made, to make it irreversible. And there was another message that Draghi wanted investors to hear. Within our mandate, the ECB is ready to do whatever it takes to preserve the euro. Then, pausing for effect, he added, and believe me, it will be enough. In retrospect, Draghi's whatever it takes speech has come to be seen as the turning point of the Eurozone crisis. In the aftermath, markets immediately calmed. Yields for the most vulnerable borrowers came down. There was no more talk of a Eurozone breakup. It is an explanation with deep appeal. The ECB had held the key to stability all along. Draghi, finally, was the one to turn it. But this is a retrospective construction. The more or less open struggle over the direction of ECB policy that had begun back in 2010 was not ended by Draghi's speech on July 26th. His initial intervention was extremely fragile. It could easily have been undone. It took a lot of help to make Draghi's speech into a historic turning point, and even then it was painfully incomplete. In the hours that followed Draghi's address, as its import sank in, there was confusion at ECB headquarters in Frankfurt. As one senior ECB official commented to Reuters, "Nobody knew this was going to happen. Nobody." The ECB's media department and the editors of the bank's webpage did not have an advance copy of the speech to make available to the press. Draghi had vaguely discussed his plan with a few of his fellow executive board members, but given its likely impact, he had clearly felt it was better to hold the decision close and to present the world with a fait accompli. Significantly, Jens Weidmann,